It's finally...
Holy shit, it's here.
What's ready?
Finally here, Maps Yellow, a.k.a. Maps Prime.
Oh my God, finally.
It's coming to you by Friday.
Friday, we're going to launch it. This is our most ambitious and original Maps program yet.
Nothing fucking out there like it. If you want to know more information about it, you go to the Mind Pump Show Facebook page.
We did a Facebook Live and we covered pretty much everything you need to
know. We talk about the whole thing. You can learn all about it. It is launching Friday. You will get access to it. Now, when this airs, it should be available to the forum as well early. So if you want early access and an additional discount, become a member of the forum. Otherwise, look out for it Friday. Maps Prime coming at you.
Make sure you get it early. Free t-shirts coming with it.
It's coming in hot.
You'll find it at mindpumpmedia.com.
If you want to pump your body and expand your mind, there's only one place to go. Mind Pump. Mind Pump with your hosts, Sal DiStefano, Adam Schaefer, and Justin Andrews.
Hey, Mind Pump listeners, you're going to hear us interview a very interesting fellow. One of the leaders of...
Some motherfucking man.
Yeah, of a movement in the fitness industry. It's Aubrey Marcus, the founder of Onnit. Probably one of the one supplement companies we don't talk crap about.
Yeah, one of the very few.
Yeah, so we talked to him about business, but then we talked to him a lot about personal stuff. Very interesting episode.
Got into some of his ayahuasca experiences.
His philosophy on open relationships, a little bit of fitness stuff thrown in there. You can go to his website, onnit.com, or you can listen to his podcast. He actually hosts a podcast called the Aubrey Marcus Podcast. So here we go.
I want to hear the origin story.
Okay.
Yeah, I want to hear how this started. Because on our show, we talk so much crap about the supplement industry and the fitness industry. And since the beginning, Onnit kind of stood out to us as a company that we respected because of the direction you guys go. And you're not like the typical bodybuilding supplements. You're not the typical, you know, bullshit type of stuff. And so I'm interested to know what got you to start Onnit?
I don't want him to start too fast forward. Can I get you to go further back to because I don't know much about your childhood and upbringing too. So that's, I'm curious about that, where that started and what drove you to be the man you are today. And then Onnit.
I think the origin story of Onnit and all that kind of ties in because, you know, my stepmother was, kind of the nutritional doctor for all of Pat Riley's teams. And I was a huge basketball player. So it was the Lakers in the 80s. It was the Knicks in the 90s, the Heat in the 2000s. But anyways, growing up, you know, I was always playing ball and, you know, doing well in school, doing what I could. And every time I would have a game, I would get a stack of supplements that would be laid out on a napkin or a paper towel. And I wouldn't know what the hell they were. I would just know that this is game day. So I'm going to take this paper towel full of supplements. And I could tell a noticeable difference versus like a practice day or your regular day. And on test day, I didn't know what supplements I was taking either, but I knew that there were a different set of supplements, different shapes, different color vitamins, and, you know, different kind of preparation for that. And so I got used to that paradigm of taking things and doing things that would improve my performance in specific things. And I think that early conditioning got me used to that idea, like, okay, input equals output. There's things that I can do, ways that I can prepare myself that's going to yield a better performance. And that always stuck with me. And that was something that I continued to apply through my life, whatever I was doing, even in, you know, even in a social setting, even in a party setting, like how do I prepare to rage all night at the club? Like, what is the best thing I can do? And then how is the best way, you know, what is the best way I can recover? And, you know, that was part of the Onnit origin story as well, is like coming up with nutrient combinations that helped you recover from when you were exhausted, whether it was from partying or working or overtraining, and then transition that when I got with Joe Rogan, our partner in this beautiful project we have here, and asked him, you know, all right, Joe, what do you think you would like to take the most? And he said, I would love a nootropic. And I said, all right, we'll get to work and we'll make the best nootropic we possibly can, combining the research, the access that we had to the athletes and doctors and all the knowledge that I had gained from that paper towel of supplements that I used to take, that eventually I started to learn what they were when I got to be an adult, because I couldn't just stop by my stepmom's house and get the paper towel. Eventually, I had to wipe my own ass, you know, and figure out the supplements on my own. And, you know, put that all together and that launched Alpha Brain. And really with Alpha Brain, I think was the start of Onnit's true origin story.
So that was your first product was Alpha Brain.
We flirted around with some like party recovery supplements, you know, just kind of basically doing something that that would be convenient for myself, like things instead of when I'm all hungover, taking 9 different bottles of supplements, which I was oftentimes too lazy to do. I was like, man, I'd really love if this was just in one pill and I could take it. And so it was, you know, in some ways born out of that necessity. But really, you know, as again, you know, me kind of growing up through my journey, that kind of party lifestyle was more indicative of me being unhappy with what I was doing as, you know, professionally. So as I transitioned to being more enthusiastic, of course, then Alpha Brain became the ideal supplement for myself as well, something that could fuel my focus and mental capacity rather than just help me recover from a night of ridiculous debauchery.
And that was like 5-6 years ago?
That was July 2011 we launched Alpha Brain.
Wow. So that's pretty, I mean, great foresight, right? Because at that time, nootropics were kind of this underground. It wasn't like this thing that athletes were using. You had some
pre-limitless. That's what I always tell people.
After
that movie, everybody was interested. But before that, man, you had to be kind of ahead of the game to be already.
And you were kind of marketing it towards athletes at that time. And I don't think nootropics really were marketed to athletes, which is kind of fascinating.
We were marketing it towards anybody who was trying to improve performance, and athletes in particular have more on the line. I mean, like athletes. Term loosely, because we were really actually targeting like poker players and, you know, kind of a lot of more of the mental athletes, as well as some of the other, you know, more traditional physical athletes. But that just kind of gravitated towards our product. But anybody who relied on performance as part of their, you know, part of their success was really kind of our niche. And too many times supplement companies were trying to cure a disease condition, which first of all, isn't even legal. You know, you're not allowed to go out and try and cure diseases with supplements. That's the realm of pharmaceuticals. You know, really what you're supposed to do is help people who are relatively good become great, or help people who are healthy become even better. And that's, we just decided that's the reason that I use supplements. And that's what I wanted to focus on, is just finding ways to help everyday people improve their performance in dramatic ways and do it with something you could feel. You know, all other times, too many supplements, it was like you take it and 90% of what you felt was imagination. You know, like, I think it's good for me. I heard it was good for me. They're saying it's good for me, but you didn't feel shit.
Well, you guys funded a double-blind placebo-controlled study.
On Alpha Brain alone.
Did they show? And I'm familiar with one of them. I didn't know there was two of them.
Yeah, both of them done by the Boston Center for Memory, both of them backing up the research. So one of them was a smaller kind of pilot trial, and then we backed a larger trial. And, you know, over 60 people in the trials combined. And what it showed is improvement in executive function, improvement in focus, improvement in reaction time of the brain, like the brain's ability to receive stimulus and then register that stimulus. We hooked people up to an EEG. And we actually even tracked, too, that we showed that from the EEG testing versus placebo, that Alpha Brain was effective after the first dose. So again, that idea is, this isn't something you have to take and then 2 weeks later, you imagine you're feeling better. You know, it's something that you can take it and you can feel it. And I think that's been the hallmark of the Onnit supplements, is you take it, you notice it, and you're like, oh, shit, something's different. And that's really what been kind of the guiding star of most of what we do.
When you had this, was this always the vision, was just a supplement company? Because you guys are so much more than that.
No.
So much more than that.
Yeah.
So did you foresee all the other things that you guys going on with the Onnit Academy and the mace bells and the kettlebell? Mm. Like, did you see all that back then? Or?
Well, it's something that I knew from my own life was essential. You can't just, there's no magic pills. Limitless pills.
Beautiful.
There's no magic bullets, right? You can't just do one thing and hope to achieve success. Everything is connected. You know, your mind, your preparation, your body, your emotional state, your everything goes into it. And supplements are just one piece of that puzzle. So it's like, if we're going to promote something that's really going to help people get from good to great, help people get from okay to good, whatever their goal is, we got to talk about everything. And that's where that total human optimization package was born. So what kind of, you know, fitness routines, what kind of equipment is going to best work with the body to bring out the maximum potential? What kind of nutritional protocol, what kind of mindset programs, you know, and then even all the way down to personal care, you know, people don't realize that what you put on your body gets in your body. You know, your skin is not this impermeable Tupperware. You know, this is living, breathing, and the stuff we put on our body gets in our body.
You know, I came to that conclusion not that long ago, where I realized, you know, I was paying attention to my nutrition, then I was paying attention to the types of supplements I was taking, and then I'm like, holy shit, look at my hairspray, my gel, my deodorant. Like, this is the stuff I put on. Yeah, my toothpaste. Like, why does my toothpaste have chemicals in it that make it sud? You know, create bubbles. You know, you realize that does nothing to clean your teeth.
No.
It's just because consumers like to have suds in their mouth when they brush their teeth, and it makes them feel like they're doing a better job.
Squeaky clean.
Where did that evolve? Where did that come from? When you think about it,
that's all. I think it's consumer driven. People think they want something. They associate suds with cleaning. Like you wash your hands and it gets bubbles and you're like, it's getting cleaner.
Sodium lauryl sulfate.
Yeah, so they put this in there so you get these bubbles in your mouth. And reality, you just brush your teeth with water or baking soda and you're probably just as fine.
Good to go.
Yeah. So your personal, you have this personal drive for kind of self-exploration, and that's what drove you to start on it. And then it sounds like you wanted to help people with it. But your drive for self-exploration didn't stop or doesn't end with supplements. I've heard you on the podcast talk quite a bit about using things like ayahuasca and learning things about yourself through that. And it seems like that's just an extension of an extension of Onnit and what you're doing. I mean,
well, I think Onnit plays a key part in the role, because the first thing you got to pay attention to is the body. You know, this is our home, right? And we got to shore that up, because you look at any animal, and I think sometimes we fail to look at ourselves like an animal. We think, oh, we're a person and our mind is everything. Like, we're an animal, and things are going to be coming up from the body that are going to translate into thoughts and translate into different ways we perceive the world. I mean, you go up to a tiger that's well-fed and healthy, there's a good chance he might want to play. It's a good chance he might want to hang out. You know, you go up to a tiger that's sick and hungry and exhausted, you know, that tiger's gonna fuck you up. You know, like, he doesn't give a shit about you. He's like, and that's the way people are. When people are sick and exhausted and tired and their body isn't right, they don't give a shit about the world. They don't care about other people. They're not gonna look at another person who's saying something shitty to them as them living a different life. They're not gonna come from a compassionate place. They're not gonna take the steps to make this a better game that we can all mutually play together. They're just gonna look out for themselves. We get very myopic when we're not well. And so Onnit, you know, the goal of Onnit is to get people to a state where their body is thriving. And if their body is thriving, then you can start working on their consciousness. Then you can start working on spirituality, you know, honing in your emotional states and different practices.
So the body's like the bottom.
It's the bottom.
Start with that.
Like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you got to take care of the body first. And of course, a lot of people want to be of service to the world, you know, but in order to be of service, you got to be fit for service. And part of being fit for service is to making sure that your body is also fit for service.
So the evolution of that is body, and then you go to mind, and then spirit, and then take it from there.
So something we talk a lot about is, you know, we're three kind of meathead looking guys, but we all have different backgrounds in fitness. And one of the
you kind of got that Game of Thrones vibe. Right? Jason Momoa thing. Oh,
that's just right now, bro. Yeah. That's just right now. Normally there's a baby face going on.
He's a meathead.
That's just me trying to toughen my look up right now. But one of the things that we try and preach all day long on our show is just that people want to put us in a box, man. They want everybody to be in this box of like, oh, you're in this camp, so you only do this, or oh, you do this, or oh, you do that. And one of the things that always turned me on about your company was you guys were introducing things like the mace bell and kettlebells and tools like this. They've been around forever. And I'm a bodybuilder, right? So I'm supposed to lift a certain way. I'm supposed to go over and use all these machine exercises and do finisher moves and do all this bullshit exercises that all bodybuilders do. And I was always looked at really weird because I'd be using kettlebells and tool Indian clubs and tools like this. What led you down that path to start utilizing tools that have been around forever like that? Why aren't you just using dumbbells and basic tools out there?
You know, honestly, that came from my exposure to really high level athletes in really dynamic sports. So one of my best friends was Bodie Miller, who's an Olympic skier, and then also was friends with a lot of MMA fighters. And watching the type of training they did, I mean, nothing in those sports is linear. You know, everything, you're adapting to terrain, you're adapting to conditions. And to go to the gym and just for Bodie to just do squats and lunges, like, not going to be enough. For a fighter to just do bench press and pull-ups, not going to be enough. So they started to be kind of the innovators and early adapters to these movement patterns. And so, you know, the kettlebells were starting to creep in, but then we looked a little deeper and saw that, all right, well, people have been solving this problem for a long time. And then the Persian Pelwani elite and some of the elite warriors from our past developed like mace training, which they called gada, and then the Indian club training, which were the heavy wooden clubs at that point. And they were doing that to overtrain movements that they were using in battle, these kind of rotational circular movements, you know, and that's really what we're using more often than not in any kind of dynamic sport. And it also works with the body a lot better. You know, it's not overloading certain systems and then causing others to compensate and creating these really structurally funny but aesthetically pleasing conditions within the body. So, you know, just following that path to its fruition and knowing that everything has a place. There is a place for barbells and the heavy weights and stacking on and getting to maximum load. And then there is a plate for completely restorative kind of myofascial and durability training. And then there's that place for those bridges in between where you're doing Mace 360s and working the shoulder girdle and your intercostals and getting everything to work together. And of course, then other disciplines like yoga and all of these things filling in the gap so that you could create an optionally functioning human.
Well, you say that so nonchalant, but don't you feel like nobody else is really giving this message?
Right.
I mean, this is, if you were to listen to our show, you would know that we feel so alone in this, in the fitness industry that no one is like that. You guys are probably the only other company I could think of that really.
Yeah, I've been using Indian clubs for a long time, and I think you're the first company that has really highlighted that as a valid tool that I was teaching clients a long time ago. So, mm-hmm.
And you're not just married to that, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I think what's interesting is, and we're starting to see this now with a lot of different markets, but fitness, health, and wellness is doing this now. Is, you know, we moved away from what was old into what was new, and now what was old is new again. We're going back and we're revisiting. You know, you talk about we're just animals, right? And yep. Which is it's so fucking true. I mean, I've talked about this in the past. Like, we think we're so complex and so smart, but look at the clothes we wear. Look at the shit we do. Look at women wearing high heels and makeup, and look at the way we comb our hair. Like, those are all driven by animal instincts. And some of these ancient cultures, the way they've developed some of these exercise techniques and movements, they didn't have the science to explain why they work so well. We do now, but we see why they work so well. Like yoga. Yoga is very, very, very old. I can't think of one particular discipline that builds functional flexibility quite as well as yoga. Now, if you combine a bunch of different things, you can kind of get there. Mm-hmm. But by itself, I can't think of anything that does as good of a job as making you strong within ranges of motion like yoga does. And yoga is old as hell.
Yeah.
You know, these you're talking about these clubs, Indian clubs. There's some pictures of some Indian wrestlers. Old. This is back in the 1800s and before.
13th century it goes back to.
Where these guys were working out with these devices doing these movements that they didn't know, like, this is deltoid and tricep and I'm working within this VO2 max. It's like, we've done this now for thousands of years. It works. And when I do this, I can kick another guy's ass and I'm in better shape.
Well, even then though, the people now that are in they're in a camp though still. That's what drives me crazy. Like, how often do you meet somebody who's into yoga, but then also deadlifts 300-400 pounds? You know what I'm saying? Or how often do you meet somebody that's all into Indian clubs and they're out using amazing, you know what I'm saying? I think
people fall into the trap of using certain identity to shit on other people, you know, and it's this weird thing. It doesn't matter if it's veganism, mm-hmm. or you know, unconventional club and kettlebell training or barbell training. It's like, this is my thing and everything else sucks because I'm better than you. And that's all just games.
Tribalism.
It's all just games of the ego. Yeah, it's a form of tribe. It's the dark side of tribalism, right? Where you identify with a certain group and then shit on everybody else. And that's nonsense, you know? And I think one of the strengths of Onnit is to be inclusive, to say, no matter what is out there, you know, we'll look at the strengths and we'll appreciate those and say, man, you guys are doing this really good. And, you know, what about this other stuff? Mm. This other stuff's really good, too. And with that attitude, I think you get the best results. And you also, you know, start to build bridges between these different camps where the truth lies. The truth lies that there's good in everything. There's good in CrossFit. There's good in bodybuilding. There's good in unconventional training. There's good in all these things. There's weaknesses in all these things. Let's try and, you know, harness as many strengths as we can. Let's try to eliminate as many weaknesses as we can. And then create the most well-rounded picture that we can build.
Were you into fitness before you did all this? You were saying.
Yeah, I've been an athlete in a variety of ways my whole life.
Okay.
Never great enough at anything to be like known, but good enough at most things.
So were you educated in fitness as well?
Through just, you know, the performance training that I had to do. You know, everything was very, very functionally based. Like, if I want to increase my vertical jump, all right, these are the plyometrics that are necessary for this. If I need to increase speed, quickness, whatever attribute, strength, you know, and working with really talented trainers and then training beyond the point that I was competing with elite athletes who were doing that for a living. Mm. And then figuring out, oh, so why are you doing this? What's your warm-up routine? All right, why are you doing this? Okay, here we go. I remember going out, like particularly to use Bodhi again as an example, like going to Bodhi for a park workout sounds like fun. It's like, hey, you want to go to the park and work out? And then I'm doing lateral jumps over a fucking picnic table. You know, I'm like, what the hell am I doing? I didn't even know I could do this, you know? And so that's, you know, that's the kind of the way that I expose myself to a lot of it. And then, you know, then tried to back it up with some of the book smarts, but I always rely on, you know, the experts who are better than that at me to educate me. And I'm, you know, just try to put myself in perpetual student mode and always just learning and trying and seeing what works best.
Where does that come from for you? Where does your philosophy come from? Where does that open-mindedness come from? Where does it stem from?
I think it's just a real desire to track the truth. You know, like I don't have like a vested interest. There's nothing I need to defend. I'm just fairly comfortable with not having to prove anything to make myself feel better or worse. I just want to find out what's best.
Rare there. Do you attribute to like your parents or friendships or relationships? Did you have something traumatic? I mean, has it always been that way for you?
In some ways, truth was something that I had a very hard time of like avoiding. Like I couldn't deny it. Some way it was like, you know, some people can listen to an instrument and know when it's out of tune. You know, like a great musician can listen to a flute and be like, oh man, it sounds like there's a crack in there, or play a piano and be like, oh yeah, the levers need to be tightened. You know, I can't do that. I have no idea. I can't hear music that way. You could play this, the worst out of tune guitar, and I'd be like, man, Gypsy Kings, amazing. You know, like, I don't know. But with truth, I always had a knack for figuring out what was real and what was not real. And I think that was helping. And I would try and I'd play games with myself and deny it. But I think that's where, you know, some of the plant medicine and some of the practices like flotation and meditation, different things, allowing myself to empty out the contents of the identity and access myself and as a being of consciousness, that really helps with all that. Because then you realize what you are and then you have much less to defend.
Do you find that wanting to search for truth, because I can identify with that sentiment and that feeling, but I find, just speaking personally, that sometimes it almost feels almost like a burden, because you see people walking around and they seem to be content. And I always feel like I'm trying to search for something, and I need to do these different things to test myself, to learn more. And it's never ending. I don't think it ever does end, right? It never will end.
No.
Do you ever find yourself saying like, God, it's exhausting, constantly be looking, you know, and searching and.
Yeah, I think so. And I think then also you have to realize that the game is the search. And I think when you get too goal focused and be like, oh, when I figure this thing out, everything's going to be great. Or when my company gets to this level, it'll be great. Or when I can achieve this physical thing, it'll be great. And then you're not enjoying the present, you've really lost the game. Because all there is the ride. All there is the journey. Like, winning is not about getting to some point. It's about enjoying the process of going for your win. Like, that's the only key part of it. And I think reframing that is really key. And that eliminates so much of the discomfort of the situation. Just know that being on the path is exactly the state that you will always be in. You're never going to, everything is a false summit. There is no actual summit. As soon as you achieve a goal, you're going to be working towards the next goal.
It feels sometimes like, you know, you're trying to get away from ego, and sometimes you end up moving towards it. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm going to learn these things and become more spiritual, but then I'm identifying with that. And now that's who I think I am.
It's sticky. There's traps everywhere.
That's how powerful ego is.
I was just going to ask you, someone who is so self-aware, I mean, what are your demons? What are the things that get you in that trap? Or
we all same as everybody, you know, we all these, me personally, I think, you know, I think one of the things is we play all these games like this. This is like the grand game, but we play games within the games. Like, we have these goals, we have these things that we're pushing towards. And part of one of the traps we can fall in is playing it like it's life or death. You know, like everything that happens, you make a post, you say something, your reaction, you get all wrapped up into that, into the expression of what's happening or the success or failure. You're attached to so many things. And I think that's the biggest challenge for me, is to just clean the attachments that I have, to know that, you know, doing my best, going out there, laying it out there, and fuck the consequences, fuck the outcome of what happens, you know, just do what I can do, enjoy the process of doing it, and enjoy the results no matter what happens. And I think that's the thing, because it's easy to look at it life or death. It's easy to look at the success of Onnit as life or death, or the success with, you know, a girl, or the success with this. Take everything like it's going to be life or death, but there isn't anything that's life or death. Even life or death, you know, based on my own personal spiritual experiences, isn't life or death. You know what I mean? Like there's something that exists and survives beyond death. So nothing is life or death. So relax, like have some faith, you know, enjoy the process and just take some of that stress off. And if I look back at and give advice to my younger self, it'd be exactly that, you know, like take, like enjoy it.
Like it's okay.
It's okay. And that's the thing. We're all practically batting 1,000, you know, like we're here, we're healthy enough. Things are, everything that bad that happened, we can look back and say, you know, I'm actually grateful for that because it taught me this thing. We're like batting 1,000, except when we look at the future, we're looking at it like we're striking out left and right. You know what I mean? Like, and so just reframing that and being like,
especially when you compare yourself to others, you know, that's one of the worst things.
That's an unwinnable game.
As Onnit started growing, did you have any moments where that was really challenging for you? Like, I know for us, like as we started growing our show, and then you get your first like hater or your first person that's criticizing you and you're like, fuck, you know, my God, this person, like,
especially when they attacked you, that's something that you're really you're very proud of, like that, you know?
Totally.
Yeah. Did anything like that happen to you?
Of course. I mean, I'd never experienced, when you're small enough, you don't really get a lot of haters because they would have to really come knock on your door and be a shithead. And that's really rare. But when you get to on a bigger platform, then they come out. I mean, I remember when I launched with Rogan, I mean, there was a lot of hype and a lot of buildup, and I was doing a lot of podcasts, and you know, I was foolish in some ways. I was being a jackass in some ways, and you know, they latched on to a few of these things, created a lot on their own as well. But there was like whole websites dedicating to shitting on me. And I was
What were they saying?
Yeah. Aubrey Marcus has been a fraudster his whole life.
He's been blah blah.
So some of it was just total nonsense, and some of it was like, look at this fucking asshole thing he said on this post and this thing. And there was, you know, I was reacting emotionally sometimes. So a lot of what people were pointing out was real. And then sometimes the momentum of it and was just piling on, and they were creating things out of nothing as well. But that whole thing really, really shook me. I mean, I was like really shook because I wasn't used to that, nor was I expecting that. So on one hand, we had this great success. On the other hand, there were people who hated me, who didn't know me, who were saying things that were completely unjust. And, you know, and for me, someone who knows truth, like I know when I fucked up, and I fuck up all the time, but I also know when someone's saying some shit that's really fucking wrong. And that was like getting me mad. I was like, you're fucking wrong. Like, I get it when I'm wrong. Like, I'm the first to kick my own ass. Like, trust me. You know, if you're saying something within the boundaries of the amount of ass that I kick on myself, like, all good.
Right.
But you're making shit up here. Yeah. And that pissed me off at first. And, you know, again, man, I keep bringing up Bodhi, but he was really essential in that initial stage. He was also the first investor in the company. But I went to him, and he had a case of that in the Torino Olympics, where he was on like the cover of Time magazine. He was supposed to win all these medals, and the press saw him out partying and drinking, which is what Bodhi did before all the races. So it wasn't anything unusual, but the idea that you're supposed to prepare for the Olympics in a certain way and take it super seriously. He's like, fuck that. I'm in Italy and I'm in the Olympic village. Like, I'm only going to
be party.
I'm going to do what I always do. And so the combination of him not winning, and because they blamed it on that, right? And Bodhi usually either wins or crashes, and it just happened at this Olympic Games. Despite his world championships and his subsequent gold medals, he crashed in this Olympics rather than won. And so his rating, I guess the agencies keep track of this, his rating was actually the lowest rating of any athlete, even lower than O.J. Simpson after he presumably killed his wife. Right, so he was getting...
That'll fuck you up right there.
He was getting like death threats. He was getting like so much hate, like mail, like actual mail.
Wow.
Coming. And so, you know, when I was talking to him about it, you know, he'd been through the other side, and he said, look, man, you cannot allow anybody else to judge your performance, good or bad. You know, like, no matter what you did, you are the only person who knows how much work you put in, how much effort you did, and what you actually did. Like, don't let anybody kick your tires and make that important. Don't let anybody tell you something bad that you did and value that as important. Take it all as data. All it is data, but you're the only judge. You know, and you have to focus on that.
It's great advice. And
it's so hard to practice, though, man. When you're on the receiving end of that, especially when you've got people on social media or you see reviews or whatever, I mean, that could fuck with you big time. Yeah. When did plant medicine come in? Is it right around that time where you were starting to discover that?
I've been on the plant medicine path since earlier. You know, I did a vision quest when I was like 18.
Oh, wow.
And went off into the mountains in New Mexico. And that was really, really powerful. That really opened me up to a whole another spiritual dimension where I felt my body evaporate and something else exist. And I was like, oh, well, there's something else besides this.
And that was your first time experiencing anything like that?
It was.
Wow. Yeah.
So then that kind of set me off in a different path. And that's another beautiful way. And it's been a way to kind of recalibrate myself. And it's a way to escape from the identity, to access myself as consciousness, as something beyond this physical body, beyond this mind, the thinker behind the thoughts, the, you know, the force that is animating this life, not the life itself. And identifying as that is a great other way to escape from, you know, the hate and the identification and the attachment to your image and what you're doing. Just understand that, you know, your consciousness and you're playing in this human avatar, in this amazing game board that we have to play, but your consciousness and that's really who you are, and that's enough. And that's worthy of love.
Now, you call it medicine. What is it treating? What are you using it to treat? Because medicine is very different. When, you know, when people use the term medicine, it's like, I'm taking this because it's doing something for this particular ailment or issue, and I'm treating this one particular thing. What is it? What is it doing? Why is it called medicine? Why? Because I've heard people refer to it as medicine. I've heard other people refer to it as ayahuasca or, mm-hmm. you know,
or drugs
or drugs or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Why do you call it medicine?
Because it's been medicinal, you know, and I think right now we're in an interesting time because the clinical research has shown actual medicinal properties.
Totally.
And there's a recent study that just came out on depression for use of psilocybin, and anxiety studies and palliative care, mm-hmm. end of life care. Social anxiety was another great study that just came out studying MDMA mm-hmm. and psilocybin. So we're actually proving actual medical conditions, but in general, you're treating all of the manifestations of the mind, all of the ways that the mind can drive us from suffering, from a state of what can be bliss into a state of suffering. And that's really what it tends to do. Now, it can also just be a fun ride, and it can also be challenging. It's not for everybody. It's not a panacea. But when used with the right intention, with the right person, the right time, the right intention, it can be incredibly powerful.
Now, someone who's around it a lot, do you feel like a lot of people abuse it, or do you think for the most? Because I feel like if you're going to do ayahuasca, I feel like you're not like a real drug seeker. You are normally seeking for...
Ayahuasca is miserable to do. Like, I don't know. Like, the show me a recreational ayahuasca. I'd love to meet that motherfucker. Because you're nauseous. You're either shitting or puking.
We were supposed to be going this weekend.
They keep trying to sell me on it. Yeah. I'm just like,
You know, you're confronting your deepest fears and your demons. I mean, the first time I did it, I was like, I had insects in my vision, insects crawling in my eyes and exploding out of my face. I had eels crawling, like swimming up from the water and burrowing into my stomach and thrashing around in my intestines and bursting out of my chest. I was sliding down a vine of thorns naked. And then ayahuasca told me I had cancer.
That was like the first four hours of just dealing
with everything, all of the worst parts. But then you confront these fears and then you move past these fears. And again, like in any good stoic philosophy, the resistance becomes assistance. The obstacle becomes the way. By confronting these fears, surrendering to them, moving past them, then you master them to a certain degree. And you continue that process, mastering deeper and deeper fears, uncovering different things. And therein lies the process of growth.
How many times now? I know you've done it quite a few times. How many got under your belt now?
17.
17?
Yeah.
And each time, do you feel like you get something new?
100%. No two are the same. And you know, I've worked with shamans who've done it thousands of times, and they still, every time is new. Every time is different because we're always different. You know, there's one of my favorite quotes is from Heraclitus, and it says, no man steps in the same river twice because it's not the same man and it's not the same river. Like ourself, we tend to think of ourself as one thing. Ourself is a million things. You know, the self after you have a giant barbecue is different than the self after you have a salad. The self when you wake up rested versus the self when you wake up exhausted. All of these are different variations and permutations of the self, the memories, the change of the actual, you know, physical composition of the brain and everything that's going on, the neurochemicals that are firing that day. We're a bunch of different selves. And I think, you know, recognizing that is essential, you know, in really understanding who we are, that we're always evolving. We're always changing. And so when you take a medicine, it's going to be interacting with you in that particular condition, whatever your fears are, whatever things that are going on. It's not going to be the same ride every time.
Now, are you afraid that because, you know, you've got people like you talking about it and you've got other you know, personalities talking about using things like ayahuasca, even, you know, LSD. Are you afraid that because it's getting more popular that the people are going to start using it for the wrong reasons, or people are going to have the wrong idea of using these substances? Because like you said, it's miserable.
Or do you care?
Or do you care? I feel like there'll be some people listening who are going to be, oh, I want to do that. And then it's like it's going to scare them, or it's the wrong thing. I mean, is there any thought of that? Or
yeah, I mean, I definitely caution people that, you know, don't go running to this thinking it's going to be a fun game or a panacea. Like, you should come to it ready and sober and earnest and humble and just ready to learn. And if you come with that attitude and it's with the right person, mm-hmm. you know, I think it can be a very powerful experience. But, you know, there's going to be some, if this gets extremely popular, there's going to be some, you know, some downside. You know, I think it's just part of life. Like, we accept it. I mean, there's tens of thousands of pharmaceutical deaths. You know, it doesn't stop people from releasing pharmaceuticals because at the core, they have the potential to help. Now, some maybe don't, but, you know, as a general idea, the idea is that these are going to help some people, they're going to hurt some people, you know? And I think, but it's funny, like, you'll have one case of someone getting hurt from psychedelics and everybody freaks out. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just, you know, we push away that which we're afraid of, and we're afraid of our own demons. We're afraid of uncovering our true self. We're afraid of that mirror being held up that we can't look away from that shows us, you know, our true
nature.
That's
terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Terrifying for most people.
That's got to be the scariest thing.
And we're addicted to control. You know, mm-hmm. we think we're in control, even though we never are. You know, we think we have everything all figured out and I'm going to be in control and I know best. And this is teaching you surrender because you have no other fucking choice but to surrender.
So do you think that we're controlling what happens to us in the future? Or do you think we're reacting to what's supposed to happen?
Depends. And I think that's...
Or is it different? Or does it even matter?
It matters because I think the game is only fun when we have choice. You know, otherwise we're playing out a movie, you know, or somebody else's movie and or being played by another game. I think we're here to access as much choice as we can. But in order to have free will, we have to step back to the consciousness level. We have to be the thinker behind the thoughts, not the thoughts themselves. We have to be the person behind the emotions, not the emotions themselves. And if we're not, then we're going to be driven by our own fears and greeds, and we're basically going to be a robot, you know. And I think the way that the game is the most fun is when we can step back and then really have all of our options available and decide, all right, I want to play this game. I want to play this game. You know, maybe I do want to play the rolling real slow in my Bugatti with my fucking you blow on and just bawling out of control, but know that that's a game. Maybe I want to play that. Not that I'm compelled to do that because I need to shit on these people who doubted me and thought I was never good enough. Or maybe you just want to play that game. Or maybe you want to play the, you know, put on the robes and go hang out in a monastery and not talk to anybody for a month. Maybe you want to play that game, but be able to do it as a choice, not as some desperation that we need. You know, go to the gym because you want to go to the gym, not because you're compelled, you know, that you have to because you need to be better than this person who's now fucking your ex-girlfriend. You know, like re-harness the ability to choose what we want in life.
Now, what's it like being someone like you, meeting a partner? How hard is it to meet somebody who has similar views as a female that thinks like this? And I got to ask you some, because I've heard rumors and I want to know the truth from you, like as far as an open relationship and what that's like. And, you know, tell me a little bit about what your journey on that. Have you always been like that? Did you become more comfortable with yourself through all these experiences?
Share that. I mean, again, I know truth and I know when it's bullshit. And I think to me, it always felt like bullshit that someone should have the complete and exclusive right to your pleasure in certain parts of your body. Like, what? Like, I surrender all rights to pleasure to you and nobody else can do it? Like, that seems ridiculous.
Well, when you put it that way, sure. It makes a lot of sense. You know,
right? Like, if you had a friend, stretch my head, if you had a friend.
You got to share some conversations that you've had with past girlfriends.
I'm happy to get into this.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, if you had a friend who had an amazing restaurant and you just love that restaurant, right? And then you went out to eat somewhere else. If that friend came to you and was like, what the fuck, man? How dare you go to that fucking Indian food place? Fuck that. You know, I said the best fucking food in the world. You're only going to eat from me. You'd be like, whoa, dude. Like, chill the fuck out. Like,
I just ate there once,
what
dude.
What is wrong with you?
I'm still going to eat at your spot. Yeah.
You know, so all appetites.
Still
all,
my favorite spot. Yeah,
exactly. Mm. All appetites, we have an understanding that we like variety. We like to, you know, satiate these appetites with a variety of different things. And we understand that, except sex has been put in this taboo box. And
big time.
And it's so odd. It's just, it's an appetite like other things. And it's an appetite that has, you know, some legitimate consequences. So I can understand there's some rationale for treating it slightly different than eating a meal somewhere. I mean, pregnancy is a little longer lasting than food poisoning. But nonetheless,
it's great analogy.
I want a shirt that says that.
Yeah. It's the same thing. And I think we've been told all of these stories of possession and these stories of, you know, if you're with the right one, that's the only one you'll love. Except everybody knows it's bullshit. Because every time, you know, a married person gets around his boys, they're talking about other girls. Every time a married girl gets around, you know, their girlfriends, they're talking about how hot the waiter is or their trainer is. Like, we know it, but we're deluding ourselves into thinking that we're something else. I think it's just an acknowledgement of our innate nature. And I think Sex at Dawn really helped with that. That's a book by Dr. Chris Ryan. And going back to kind of the tribal roots of sexuality, and realizing that it wasn't always like this. Like, humans didn't always need to be like this. And he has a lot of great examples.
Well, the evidence, you know, what's kind of fucked up, and it's only fucked up because it's challenging to think this way, right? Because we're in a society, we're raised a certain way. The agricultural revolution's probably what prompted us to possess, you know, our women and possess sure. each other. But if you look at the evidence, I mean, very few mammals actually have sex when they can't get pregnant. We're one of them. Like, women have sex when they can't get pregnant. Most mammals go into heat. The male penis on humans is massive compared to other primates. We have this big dick, and it's designed to displace other men's semen. We were probably doing a lot of fucking. We probably 100%. Evolved having sex with everybody all the time. Even, you know, and it's fucked up, but that's the evidence, right?
100%. And even things like, you know, they call it female copulatory vocalization, the fact that women are louder during sex.
It's to let other people know.
It's to let other people know. Like, oh, I'm ready for sex now.
And these we're men, doing it. Come join in.
These men are, you know, one man is definitely not going to last long enough to please me, so I better put the call out.
Yeah. You know what?
Is that the theory behind that?
Man, yeah. Listen.
So much sense.
Oh, my God. Between your plunging theory and his fucking screaming. Dude, God.
You know what's funny? It's these are actually almost they're accepted theories. You know, like what he's saying. If you look at like the female orgasm, it's so much more difficult to achieve, and it's probably because she, like you said, she was having sex with multiple men. I see. Sorry, gentlemen.
And also, you know, the orgasm also, you know, is actually increases the chances of pregnancy.
It does.
You know, and so like
the last dude is the one that wins.
Yeah, it's all building toward. So we have all these clues, basically, that are clues into our genetics, except we're denying them. And I think for me, you know, I just didn't want to do that. Now, all right, so let's go fast forward. This is all practicum. This is all theory, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I had a monogamous relationship, and like most of my
How old are you right here when you're talking about this?
He's all 15.
32, 33.
Okay, so this is okay.
Right. So, and I'd had some other experiences where there were some allowances made, like, you know, we could bring in some other girls, but we all had to share it together. But I was very protective of my girl, because before I read Sex at Dawn, I thought we were more like lions. Like, it was a state of nature for one man to have multiple women and protect those women to the death. This kind of other mammalian, you know,
of course mindset. We want to think that because we're men,
of course, yeah. But really we're more like bonobos, right? Yeah. Everybody's just fucking that's everybody true. And having a blast, right? And so I read Sex at Dawn, I was like, man, this is truth. It had that harmonious truth chord in it, and the evidence behind it is like, fuck, my thinking is fucked. So the direction that we need to go is not for me to have multiple options, is for both of us to have multiple options, and that, you know, that follows both sexually and that follows with love. And then understanding that if that's the sexual base, and then looking at love, like, when a mother has, you know, mother has their first child and loves that child, and then a mother has the second child, nobody goes to that mom and says, oh man, is it hard loving your first child half as much? Because now you got to share it. Like, love is abundant. Love is not in scarcity. You can't cut it like a fucking pie. Mm-hmm. You know, it is infinite. And there's no way that, you know, giving some to one means that you have less for the other. There's time is not infinite. But then how much time is wasted when you're resentful and when you're not present and when you're thinking about something else? Like, so time is very malleable, because time in presence, time in enthusiastic, like, acknowledgement of another person is so much more valuable than the gross nature of time. So I realized, like, both from a relational standpoint and from a sexual standpoint, that being in an open relationship made a lot of sense. So convinced my other very kind of conventional thinking monogamous partner, Whitney Miller, to give this a go. And it was hell. It was hell. So the first thing that happened was I had another lover. And she was like, you know, maybe I'll be okay not having another lover. Well, meanwhile, she was just getting tortured and resentful every time I was with this other person. So then the resentment started to creep in, right? So we knew that she needed to get another lover. And I thought I was going to be cool with it. Philosophically, it made sense. Then she finally did. And then when I found out that she found out that she did, every time I would think about them having sex, I literally froze in my tracks and I wanted to vomit. Like I could not move. And then I would think about a different position. I'd be like, doggy stuff. Right? Like this happened for days until finally I was like, fuck this. Like I can't handle this. I was actually away on a trip when that happened. It's like, I can't handle this. I got to push myself through the deepest part of this fear, you know, similar to ayahuasca. Like, what's the scariest shit I can think of? So I hypothesized this scenario.
Oh, she was
right. I have to. Where I imagined her being like tied up in a stable, and he had this fucking cowboy. He's just like got a leash on, and like feeding her pig slop, and like, just dicking her everywhere and beating her.
Oh my god! And,
like, just some huge guy.
Yeah, exactly.
I just got
like,
turned
the
on.
Worst scenario possible, and I was like, and then after that. It got so bad. Spiky. Eventually, yeah, exactly. You're good at this. Next time someone needs that, maybe
you know, I'll write a whole like scene for you, dude.
Maybe they should just ask you to play it out in your head.
I will.
And then it got to the point where it was so ridiculous that I just started laughing. I was like, you know what? If she's having fun, if he's having fun, fuck it. It's going to be okay. And, you know, so that was like the first little mini breakthrough. But really what it does is it triggers all of these egoic parts of your identity. You feel like you have to be better than everybody who's with your girl. Oh, if he's a better fighter, or if he's stronger, if he's, you know, richer, if he's whatever, it'll trigger your own insecurities in that. And that's just another opportunity to work through just the shit that you have yourself. So to me, you know, the open relationship has become the absolute best thing that I could do to help work on my own ego and my own insecurities.
Nothing will challenge it like that. I can't even imagine. Man. I can't even think of anything that would challenge it.
Yeah,
like that.
I mean, plant medicine and open relationship are two of the hardest fucking things to do.
All you need is rock and roll now. Yeah, drugs and rock and roll.
Yeah, totally. And it's been incredibly valuable for both of us because we both had to deal. I'm talking from my perspective, but we both had to deal with that. And really, the only way out is consciousness. The only way out is to see, you know, your partner is you living a different life, to see the pleasure coming to her as pleasure coming to you, to enjoy and appreciate that. And there's a word called compersion, which is getting pleasure from someone else's pleasure, knowing that, you know, whatever pleasure she feels is good. And that's someone you love. So her pleasure is great. And then the person providing that pleasure to her, you know, that's your ally, not your enemy. If that person's hurting her, that's your fucking enemy.
Of course, that's different.
Yeah, that's your fucking enemy.
Unless
but
she wants
if he's
to be hurt.
Providing pleasure. Wait. So you're going to say someone who's giving someone you love pleasure is your enemy? Where the fuck is the logic in that? Hmm. You know, it doesn't make any sense. That person's your ally. That person's your friend.
But really, we have this fear. Our ego gets in the way that we're going to lose her. That he's going to win her over, and she's not coming back. And so,
that's also coming from ego. That's you thinking I own her. Yep. Yeah. You know, because if she don't want to be with you anymore,
and that's not real love. Because if you really love her, and she chooses that other person. And that's going to make her more happy. If you really love someone and they're like, you know, I would really be more happy with this person. The only response is, yeah, go. Like, totally go. If that's going to make you more happy, go. You know, that. So everything else is not love. It's all of these mechanisms of control. It's these mechanisms of ego that are masquerading as love. Like love is just truly wanting the best for that person that you're with. And so it's, you know, redefining love and redefining that relationship. And I can finally say after years of, you know, some hell and some enjoyment, that it's really the ideal scenario because me and Whitney, there's just zero resentment there now. You know, it's just, we can talk about anything. We can have fun together. We've gotten to be close friends with each other's lovers, which is nice. Cause you know, I liken it to the analogy of like, when I don't know somebody who's going to be with Whitney, when I don't know them, it's like some random person coming in and taking my favorite car for a test drive, you know, and like, I don't know what they're fucking doing with that car. Like, I don't trust that person. They could be running and, you know, ramming into curbs. They could be smoking in there. I don't know what the fuck they're doing. You know? But when it's your homie and like your homies, then it's like letting your friend borrow your car.
Which is the exact opposite of what most people like. Most people would be like, man, if my girl cheated on me, my friend, that'd be the fucking worst thing ever.
Right.
But in reality, like it sounds.
See, I've always been different. I've always told my boys, I'd be pissed you don't tell me. That's where I'll be pissed. I'd be pissed if I find out and you fucking hid it from me. That's what would make me mad.
Yeah, sure.
But you come, you come to me and you tell
but
me.
But if they thought you were going to beat their ass, that would be more incentive to hide it from you.
Right.
Yes. It sounds so logical, but gosh, I'll tell you what. If anything is going to prevent, I'll tell you what.
That's Jedi status right there.
If anything is going to prevent that type, because that what you're talking about when it comes to open relationship is really just one piece of a philosophy of acceptance, love, of dissolution of ego. It's just one piece of it. But I guarantee you that's the piece people will focus on to prevent other people from, you know, learning the rest of it, which is just, which is very important, mm-hmm. which is good stuff. And you talk about having sex with different people, man, people freak out. Like that's the thing people lose their mind the most about.
It's very threatening. You know, like you talk to Chris Ryan about how many people have burned his books and gotten so mad because the idea that someone might want to have sex with more people is so threatening.
Especially women.
Yeah, then women might want to fuck somebody.
That's a big one. That's a big one, especially women. Have you read the book A Billion Wicked Thoughts?
No.
Very interesting book done by these scientists who analyzed over a billion porn searches. And porn searches are interesting because when people are in the heat of the moment, you know, they're jerking off or whatever, they type in what they want to look up. And depending on what they click on or whatever, that tells you a lot more about people than surveys. Because in the past, we had like the Kinsey reports or whatever. But when people are writing things down, they know someone's going to read them. It's totally different than when people type in a porn search.
Yeah.
And what they find is that sexuality is... it's a lot more interesting than you think.
Way more diverse than we think.
More interesting. One of the cues, this was an interesting one. I brought this up before, but one of the cues for male arousal, straight male arousal, actually one of the number one cues is another penis. People don't realize this. Another penis is an arousal cue for straight males, and they call it the competition.
This came
cue.
From that book?
Mm-hmm. Came from that book.
Did you say that? And I feel like I don't think I ever searched big penises ever on that.
No, you don't, but let me ask you this. But let me ask you this. When you go to your top searches on Pornhub or whatever, is one of the top searches women getting fucked by big dicks or women getting fucked by small dicks? Nobody watches dudes with small dicks banging chicks. You see what I'm saying?
That's just awkward, though.
It's interesting.
I feel bad for
there's a whole lot of cunnilingus, you know.
That could be more like a fantasy thing. You want to imagine yourself as the guy with the big dick. But I know what you're saying. And I think that's like, since I've been in this open relationship, people approach me with a variety of different things. And I'll have like people who are just fucking badasses, just like studs. And they'll like reveal to me like, yeah, you know, secretly my fantasy is to have someone, you know, fuck my girl. I'm like, whoa, like, that's cool. You know, I'm like totally like, I'm embrace down. All of these things. Yeah. You know, it's really interesting. Like that is a factor in sexuality. And I think it has some evolutionary basis. Like the male-male-female, you know, the male-male-female threesome is actually, I think, if I'm correct, I think someone told me, is actually more popular than vice versa because of some weird dynamics. But everybody's different. You know, I mean, for me, that's not what fires me up. But nonetheless, you know, for the people who it does, fucking great. Like everybody just needs to relax about their sexuality. Like whatever gets you turned on, as long as it's not hurting somebody and as long as it's consensual, like go for it. We're all just pleasure monkeys. However your however your button is shaped and whatever your button looks like go ahead, like press that thing. Right. Like the last thing we want to fucking do is evaporate out of this body and look back and be like, man, I had all those buttons, but I never pushed them.
Boy, that would be terrifying.
What the fuck? Yeah. We're going to think like, oh, what, we're winning some fucking prize, some gold star? No, we're sacrificing the gold stars that we have right in front of us. All of these things that could be awesome that we're not allowing ourselves to do because of some, you know, ancient archaic ideology. You know, fuck that. Mm. You know, if you have that pleasure button, it's not going to hurt anybody. Push that bitch. You know, that, see if you like it.
That's a very, you know, I use the word evolved because I know some people listening are going to be like, well, that's not evolved. That's what I mean by evolved is to get to that way of thinking, you had to go through a lot of shedding of what you were raised to believe or what maybe even instinctually you believe a little bit, right? A little bit of that protectionism, a little bit about that ownership.
Sure.
That's a very difficult place to go. And, you know, when you read about couples going in that direction, more often than not, and I want to, you know, let people know, more often than not, it ends up where the couple breaks up. Very rarely does it strengthen a relationship. I think it takes two people who to be very, very evolved in that sense. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it depends. I mean, I think it's going to get harder probably before it gets easier. So if there's, you know, if you can't withstand the heat, it's going to, you know, it might cause you to crumble. But maybe that was supposed to crumble anyways. You know what I mean? So I don't know. I mean, I don't think there's that many people who are, and everybody tries to put this in different categories. There's, oh, you're a swinger, or oh, you're a this, or
right.
Like, and I think all of the categories and identifications are really just nonsense, you know? Like, even
it's trying to put you in a box again. Yeah, like I
exactly.
Said. Everybody wants
exactly.
to put you in
just,
a box. Like,
you know, for me, it's just about been following the truth that I know about love and the truth that I know about sexuality. And this is the way.
True to yourself. Feel. That's yeah, what it really exactly. is about. True to yourself. If you had, and that's the thing that I always struggle with. It's like, if I have a feeling, if I have a desire, if I have something that I want to do, to not do it because somebody else made a law, somebody else made a rule, I feel like that's worse.
Well, as long as you're not hurting anybody.
That's what I mean. Yeah. If it's for something, if it's for me, like to deny yourself that's the real crime, you know, to take that away from yourself. Like you said, I love the analogy of the buttons, you know, you in this, you go like, God, I had all this cool shit yeah. I could have done. I wish I would have done that, you know?
Yeah. It's like you're driving in playing a video game and you just don't use any of the buttons on your right thumb.
No turbo.
You know, like what?
Yeah,
like,
turbo the whole time.
Yeah, exactly.
I was just pushing A.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fuck. I was just jumping in place. Yeah. All right. So switching gears, let's talk a little bit more about
I got it because we have so much respect for what you're doing. We talk so much shit about all the other people out there doing bad shit. I want to hear where your mind is at, where we're going with Onnit. Where do you see the future of this company? I see all the people that you've affiliated yourself with. I feel like it's that you've fostered this community of lots of great minds and different directions, and you don't seem like that company where it's like it's all about Onnit and only Onnit. I feel like you have people that are underneath or affiliated with you guys, but they're still doing their own thing too. Like, mm-hmm. I love the culture that you're creating. Where do you see the future of this company in the next 5-10 years?
You know, I just want to stick true to being as real and as transparent and as, you know, kind of authentic as we can. And just, you know, again, track truth to the best we can, you know, put out the best products. If we put out something, you know, and say it's great, that it's actually great, and make sure that we continue that path of really being of service. You know, I think that's the key thing. Everything is built upon this idea of reciprocity. And I think always giving more than we take is the key. And so, you know, I'd love to see this thing continue to be something that can support people. And you know, if it grows bigger, which I anticipate that it will, great. You know, but I think one thing for me to be mindful of is to not push it to grow so fast that we have to make sacrifices. And that can be an impulse that you have. Like we got to get this thing to grow. We got to get this thing to grow. But really staying true to just the core principles.
It's very challenging to do when you start to get where you're at. I mean, every time, like, we're in a growth spurt right now. And when you get in this point in your company, it's really easy to get misguided in different directions, whether it be for money or partnering.
It's got to be one of the biggest mistakes businesses do when they grow, is they grow too fast. You see evidence of that all the time. I mean, in the fitness industry, we had in our day when Curves. Remember Curves? Remember that gym train? It just exploded, grew way too fast, and then crumbled under its own weight. It's got to be one of the biggest things. This type of academy here. Is this the only location you have like this? Where you
currently,
have the, you say currently. So I was going to ask you: are you looking to open more of these types of brick and mortar type facilities?
You know, I think we're just really kind of honing, you know, what the formula is and figuring it out. This is our kind of incubation for that idea, and then making sure that if we produce another one, that it meets these standards. You know, and I think making sure that whatever we do, it's up to the Onnit standard, and just holding that firm. And, you know, so I think part of my job is to just constantly be reflecting on that. And we're not going to be perfect. We're going to fuck up sometimes. We have fucked up before.
I was just going
to
ask you.
And then finding ways to, like, it's like, oh, fuck, we fucked that up. You know, whatever it was, it took my eye off it, didn't see it. We lost our adhesion to this principle, and just make sure to always bring it back. And just make sure that the core heart of this thing stays in the right place.
Does anything come to mind that you tried and you went, okay, I thought that was a good idea. That wasn't such a good idea. That comes to mind?
yeah, for sure. I mean, we were, you know, we're looking at, you know, acquiring different traffic sources, and, you know, we kind of let the growth hackers kind of have carte blanche to try and figure stuff out. And when we take a look at those pages, you know, some of them, I didn't like them, you know, and the customers didn't like them. You know, they didn't look right. You know, they were saying things and enticing people in a salesy way beyond what I felt was authentic, you know, an authentic expression. So, you know, we had to correct that and say, like, that's not the way, and then email those customers and come out and be like, hey, y'all all good. You can always get your money back. And that's one thing that we have consistently across. Like, we don't play games with the money back guarantee. If anybody wants their money back, you don't even have to send the product back. You know, just let us know, get your money back. Like, because all of that is games. And I don't want to create any kind of parasitic situation with anybody. And so, you know, there's little things that'll come up where we'll fuck up, you know, or, you know, I know early on we had a security breach here and we found it internally. Oh, wow. We found it internally and, you know, we very easily could have brushed it under the rug. No one else was ringing any bells, but we saw it internally. Someone had gotten some data. So I just went out and told everybody, like, hey, listen, this is what happened. We had a security breach. I'm so sorry. You guys got to change your cards if you've ordered from this time to this time. And trying to just not expecting perfection, knowing that we're going to fuck up, but always being willing to admit it, bring it back in line and kind of put it on the right path. And, you know, that's it's hard to look at something where you messed up, you know, where you could have done something better. But you ultimately have to just accept that, you know, accept the lumps and move on, pick yourself back up, do the right thing from there and make sure that you learn from that mistake.
Excellent. We appreciate the message you're putting forth with your company in a sea of, I mean, the fitness industry is just full of, you know,
shit.
We say garbage.
Say, yeah, it's full
yeah
of shit.
Just full of shit. There's a lot of shit, a lot of things that go out making people feel worse about themselves, not better about themselves. Things that don't help people actually hurt people. And you're one of the few companies, and obviously it's led by somebody with a philosophy that's a little bit different. We appreciate that. So
thank you.
With that, we'd like to thanks for coming on our show.
Yeah.
It's been a pleasure. Enjoy this conversation.
Thank you very much.
Guys.
Thanks, Aubrey.
Listen, if you like Mind Pump, leave us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes. If we like your review and we pick it, you'll win a free Mind Pump t-shirt. Also, don't forget to check us out on Instagram at Mind Pump Radio. You can find me at Mind Pump Sal, Adam at Mind Pump Adam, and Justin at Mind Pump Justin.
Thank you for listening to Mind Pump. If your goal is to build and shape your body, dramatically improve your health and energy, and maximize your overall performance, check out our discounted RGB Super Bundle at mindpumpmedia.com. The RGB Super Bundle includes MAPS Anabolic, MAPS Performance, and MAPS Aesthetic. 9 months of phased expert exercise programming designed by Sal, Adam, and Justin to systematically transform the way your body looks, feels, and performs. With detailed workout blueprints and over 200 videos, the RGB Super Bundle is like having Sal, Adam, and Justin as your own personal trainers, but at a fraction of the price. The RGB Super Bundle has a full 30-day money-back guarantee, and you can get it now plus other valuable free resources at mindpumpmedia.com. If you enjoy this show, please share the love by leaving us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes and by introducing Mind Pump to your friends and family. We thank you for your support, and until next time, this is Mind Pump.